Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Oh, and welcome, welcome, welcome. This day in January, the start of the year, sort of just getting chugging along here. My wonderful audience, the best of the best in this whole area of mental health and psychology and psychiatry. Lots of you listening from around the world. Lots of you coming up to me at conferences to thank me for doing the radio show. And I want to just thank you for listening and for doing whatever you can to spread the word. And spread the word also about PRN.FM. The station has supported me for years and years now, and I've supported them. And Gary Null is behind this show, has been somebody I've worked with many, many occasions, going back to the 70s when I was taking on my international anti-lobotomy campaign. So support PRN. And one way you can do it is through their new app. You can go to your app store and get the PRN FM app and do all those things with an app that people can do that I know almost nothing about. If I need an app, I say prayers and then I ask Ginger and I get the app. And I think it's Ginger that does it. But there is an app for PRN, and it connects to your cell phone and allows you to just go right on in and listen or work on the archives and just all the secret things that apps can do. My own website, speaking of amazing things, continues to grow. And you may remember that not long ago I created a new phenomena on the Breggin.com, which is my honored guests blog series, where I have selected a number of honored people in my experience and my professional life whom I would like to have be able to blog on the site anytime they want and without any fear of being limited in what they say about the truth about psychiatry or psychology or the drug companies or the associations. And the first blogger I asked was Peter Goetze, the wonderful, wonderful Danish physician, the author of a number of really good books. He's just a really courageous physician, and he's putting up his second blog now. It went up on Monday, and it's getting a lot of attention. And it's about efforts to get the profession to look at the problem of withdrawal and educating people about withdrawal. Got a lot going on the websites, and we keep you informed, of course, with our fairly new, not very old, frequent alerts, which are just prospering. We put out a frequent alert every week or two. We got a very interesting one out on this Monday, and this past Monday, the alert was about Peter Goetze's interesting blog. And there'll be new people joining, and new people have already said they love this idea, and we're going to just be putting out occasional blogs. I want you to know they're all going to be good and high-quality blogs. And don't forget the resource centers, 123 ECT. You can get for free dozens, if not hundreds, of articles. 123 antidepressants, and finally, 123 antipsychotics. So continue to update these and provide more and more information for you to have at your fingertips, to write a scientific article, to write a blog. I put all this research in and carefully selected PDFs and tried to see to the quality of them and worked with my research assistant, Ian, on making these the best resources you can find for scientific material and occasionally good blogs that are of a scientific quality. I also will include other resources. And again, these resource centers are on antidepressants, they're on antipsychotics, they're on ECT, and you can get them on my website or just go 123ECT, www.123antipsychotics, www.123antidepressants. So very active, things are going good on my side of the world, and I hope they are going well on yours. Today on the program, we're going to address some things that are almost never addressed. And I don't think we've ever looked at this issue on the website. On my website or on the show or any of the things that I talk about and do. And the issue is what it's like to be a family member who gets enmeshed in trying to do what's right for a family member and finds themselves being betrayed and being put in situations that he or she doesn't want to be put in, and who has her own kind or his own kind of survivor guilt from participating in this system. I'm not sure that this gets talked about hardly at all, and certainly not in my case. And let me make sure that we have our guest with us. MK, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, well, I'm glad
right
you're
here.
There. This is MK Mendoza. MK Mendoza. MK has been involved in journalism and in both radio and TV for years. And she had me recently on her new radio show. She can tell you about that if she would like. And I had just such a good time talking with her that I decided to invite her, MK Mendoza, to come and talk about anything she wanted to talk about. And one of the interests she has that I think is just so incredibly important is this issue of being a family member of somebody who gets enmeshed in the psychiatric system and what that does to you as a person, not to mention the horrific deterioration of her brother that she witnessed. So, MK, really, really glad to have you on the show. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a true honor, Dr. Breggin, and I really consider myself in the company of a true revolutionary that will go down in history. So it's a great honor to be on your show.
MK, thank you very much for that. But do call me Peter.
Okay, I will. and my thanks go also to all the revolutionaries out there, in particular also Ginger. I want to have a special note of thanks to her as well. I know she's been your sidekick. You are a team and not a sidekick. You are a team, equal team, at the helm, leading the way of changing lives and saving lives in what I think is the most important issue of this century and of our society today, the last civil rights battle that we have to fight. So I'm honored to be in your company. And also, I also want to thank all the experts out there, Peter Gercha, Robert Whitaker. You know, the list is starting to grow and go on and on. And I cannot tell you how important the voices are that you bring on to your show that you can find on Mad in America are to this cause and this movement. And you are truly allowing those of us who have personal experience on the front lines of these, in a sense, battles, because that's what we'll talk about in a second in terms of some of what the family goes through. But we're on the front lines, and you have really allowed us to bring forth our voice in the equation, and it's beyond gratitude. It's been so long awaited. So I thank you for this moment to be able to bring this voice to the table. And the reason I wanted to talk about this particular issue is because it really feels like this is kind of the gorilla in the room that nobody is talking about. And yet on a daily basis, this is what every one of us is dealing with. I mean, the family dynamics that go on when we find ourselves in the position of having one of our family members enter the psychiatric system, in my case, I believe that it literally shattered my family beyond recognition. And it's really sad and it's tragic. And what I hope to do is in talking about it, not just address some of the things that come up so that hopefully people who might have similar experiences feel less alone in that process, but also to give us hope and a way out and a way forward so that there is forgiveness and there is a way of moving forward. And, you know, there's hope. So, well, first, let me tell you a little bit about the background of my father. It's my father who was diagnosed, and he was diagnosed when I was 10 years old, and he was in his mid to late 40s. And when I found Robert Whittaker's book, which I discovered after doing my own research, my father passed away a year ago. And I really feel that his death was brought on by the long-term certainly hastened by the long-term effects of the variety of psychiatric drugs he was on throughout his entire lifetime, and one of which also included electroshock treatments, et cetera, et cetera. And he had numerous hospitalizations, but he was diagnosed mid to late 40s with bipolar. And when I read Robert Whittaker's book, it was like finding the storyline of my father's illness. And it answered many of the questions that I had and struggled with for a lifetime to answer that never quite made sense. Because I sometimes felt as though my family and I were, and me in particular, trying to justify this mental illness, almost talk ourselves into this mental illness that he so-called, you know, the so-called mental illness that he had. Now, previous to this, I also want to mention my father was a very successful oral surgeon, dentist of, you know, more than 20 years. He was the first Yale, the oral surgeon brought on to do his residency at Yale because he was so good. And by the end of his life, he was as close to a chemical lobotomy as I could say I could witness. He was hardly able to speak, and by the end, I mean, he couldn't eat, he couldn't swallow, he was just could no longer move, and basically his body shut down. And I believe this was, unfortunately, I believe that the damage was hastened by the drugs that he was on. But at any rate, the bottom line is, when he was diagnosed, what I think happens a lot of times in families is you get, as I think the psychiatric system at large puts us in unnatural, unethical roles with each other. It's just unnatural. And we were quite a close family before all of this happened. I can't say there was any major trauma. I wouldn't even say I saw my parents ever argue much. And I think what my dad had, I would describe, of course, this is just my humble opinion, and every family member will have their opinion of what happened, as in every family. But in my opinion, I think he had what would be more like a midlife crisis, a maybe even a nervous breakdown, where he had come to this country, he had made his way, and he came here already educated, by the way. He was from South America, but he was already educated by the time he got here. He had received most of his education. So he came in, you know, an upper class status. So it wasn't like he came here with nothing. And then, you know, he was already pretty well established and then just finished off his professional career here. When he was diagnosed, I think what happens is you had, in our family, this is, and I think this happens in more than my family. I think I've talked to a lot of different families now. And what happens is there's a division, and you get many people who have one side of the family who believes in the psychiatric treatments, believes in that, wants to believe in it, pushes that agenda forward. And then you have another side of the family that really, that has their doubts, doesn't quite feel good about it. And my dad was a rather intelligent man, and there were more times than not when I would hear him railing against the system as he was being put away against his will, and saying, you know, I'm not crazy, you are. And there were times I cannot, you know, I have to say that I agreed with him more than I agreed with the people that were putting him away, because the manner in which they put him away seemed unfair. He didn't seem to have a voice in his own treatment, and or his even his so-called diagnosis. And I often said I feel that the stigma did far more damage to my father than the so-called illness ever did. You know, and then once he was drugged, and again, as I read Robert Whittaker's book, it certainly explained a lot, because I really feel that, again, back to my dad's previous pre-diagnosis life, he had had quite successful life, a 20-year marriage. He was a city councilman. He was involved in the church. He was a very stable, kind of regular guy. Now, he was always a bit eccentric, always a bit revolutionary. He was always his own thinker, but I wouldn't put him in the camp of crazy by any means. Once he was stigmatized, drugged, diagnosed, I feel he almost became an entirely different person. And so there were times where as I read Robert Whittaker's book that talks about the reaction to these drugs, I felt that I could grab a graph and lay it over my father's life and say, oh my gosh, that's when he was crazy. He was going on and off the meds, in and out of treatment, you know, taking too few meds, cutting them off cold, then taking too many. And I mean, even sometimes lethal doses, because he would go off and then he would feel bad that he'd gone off. So then he would try to make up for it. I mean, his entire judgment was lacking. And again, back to that, your knowledge now, I've educated myself through obviously some of your YouTube videos, Dr. Brigham, Peter, which I really appreciate, and the notion of spellbinding, you know. But of course they give you this notion, well, he, you know, it's lack of insight. He can't see that he has his own, he has an illness. And yet now I understand that that was part of the effect of the drug. And so it was just, but there was this constant dance of, is he crazy or isn't he crazy? And you just constantly, sometimes he was absolutely inarguably crazy. And for me, now I look at that and I say, absolutely in line with the dosage of the drugs, either coming on or coming off. He, you know, if he was depressed, he was probably over-medicated. I mean, I can, like I said, if I had a graph and I could point it to the medication dosage, his behavior was in line. This out-of-control behavior showed up the most when the medications were changing. So anyway, so unfortunately, that was a struggle in and of itself. So you're, you know, and I remember even saying to my dad sometimes, do you think you're crazy? And it was like we were all, a part of all of us was trying to sort of talk ourselves into this. I mean, how can somebody not be crazy for most of his life and then all of a sudden overnight just exhibit all of these crazy behaviors? You know, and then when he was on meds, he sort of went back to his sort of normal self, except he was always kind of, you know, dampened down. So he never really returned his vivacious self, which was unfortunate and tragic. And the other piece is that you sort of see your parent dying 10 times. It's like watching your parent die only a number of times over and over and over, because they're just slowly dying sort of right in front of your eyes. And I remember many times thinking, I wish my dad was just an alcoholic. I wish I could be like my other kids, you know, other kids struggling with their families, even kids that I would say, gosh, I wish he could just beat us like everyone else gets beat, which is a horrible thing to say or wish. But what I'm pointing to is the idea that I had a problem that I didn't get to talk about. I didn't get to talk about it. I had to keep it secret. I couldn't tell anybody about it. And what I knew was the worst side of human nature, and that is the psychiatric system. It exposed me to a totalitarianism that was terrifying. So this notion of being put away against our will is, I think, the single most terrifying thing that can happen to a person, any That's just my humble opinion. But I mean, I don't even think dying is as scary. The idea of losing one's mind and then being put away against one's will is the ultimate loss of control. And so all of this made for a very scary environment. And so now you enter the walls of the family, and that family is living 24/7 in that terror, that underlying terror and shame with no place to process it. It's this quiet burden that everyone has to keep. You can't talk about it, but at the same time, everybody's terrified because deep down, everyone's terrified of being my father. No one wants to be in his position. So what happens is, and this was interesting because I, for years, sort of struggled with this silently and tried to talk myself out of thinking that I was having a hard time, that, oh, I didn't really have any real problems, but I sort of knew better underneath it. And it wasn't until I met a friend of mine, we had known each other for something like 20 years, and I was working on a video project with him, and he said, yeah, you want to help me with this? I said, what is it? He said, well, it's called The Crooked House. I said, well, what's this about? And he said, well, it's about children who grow up in mentally ill households. And I was like, wow. Oh, and I said, did you grow up in a were your parents mentally ill? And he said, and this was, of course, when I use those kind of terms, I don't use those terms as much anymore. And he said, oh, yeah, my mom, absolutely. And then we sat down and we just completely bared our souls to each other and realized that we had spent a lifetime never being able to talk to anybody. We didn't have an alcoholic. We didn't have an Al-Anon we could go to, or any. They would say, oh, it's like going to alcoholic, you know, go to Al-Anon and you'll find support there. And I went there and I didn't find it because it's very different. It's very distinct. It's a very different language. It's a very different experience. And the piece of it that's so different is the shame, the guilt, the anxiety, the unnatural roles. And so I think one of the things that we discovered was we had this sort of mutual language, and what we talked about our lives as being was the sort of collateral damage of this war that takes place within the walls of the family, because everybody's desperate to just make it go away, to just get your father back. And so one, and of course, if you have a family, if you've got a family that's torn, and in my case, if I have a mother that's siding with the system and my father who's not, and I'm torn and I'm sort of maybe siding with my dad at times, then guess what happens to me? I become guilty by association. And that's just the nature of being a child of, because under the current mythology of it being a biological genetic condition, then you're just guilty by association before you ever get out the gate. You don't even have to act weird, because the minute you get the diagnosis, I call it everyone puts on what I call their stigma glasses, and they look at you through this lens, and every action you take in life is evidence for or against the case of the crazies. Oh, she's got a case of the crazies too, like her dad. So it was, every day was a battle for literally my survival. And then what happens is I'm fighting for my survival and I'm terrified and I'm expressing myself emotionally. And then my mother's freaking out and then throws diagnosis at me. And I've now got to fight that, because God forbid, I don't want to end up like my dad. I will die trying. I'll do everything I can not to end up in those hands. So these are the kinds of things that take place that I just feel, I feel that maybe need to be shared and put out there. So maybe people know that they're not alone. And the other thing is, I mean, over time, I've also felt that, I mean, my mother and I have very much always had a rapport of trying to come to the table and meet each other and understand each other. And so we have reached a point where we do understand each other, and now she understands what I was up against and how scared I was. But for years, all that did was exacerbate her fear. You know, my fear exacerbates her fear, then she's throwing diagnoses. It's like putting fuel on the fire. And it can literally just split families apart. And a lot of what's happening with the people who are on the side of the psychiatric system is underlying that is also a huge amount of guilt and a huge amount of shame. Because we know in our intuitive selves that we are social human beings, that we affect each other. And yet the psychiatric model wants to ignore that and obliterate that idea. I mean, that it leaves it out of the equation, the picture. And yet somewhere in all of us, we know this. And so that's why I say it puts us in unnatural, unethical roles with each other and ourselves. And I myself at times was on the side of the psychiatric system as well. I went back and forth, believe me, I'm the one who had to literally testify against my father in court while he's screaming out to me that I'm crazy, not him, and put him away for the rest of his life. And how can anyone feel good about that? And yet you're being told this is the right thing to do. And of course, you can justify it as the right thing to do. And there were plenty of reasons to feel as though it was the right thing to do. I couldn't take care of him. He was way out of control. He was doing crazy things. It was potentially putting him in harm. It was putting me in harm. Otherwise, I would have never done it. But that I, as a loving daughter, had no better choices, that we as a loving family were given no better choices to support my father in his crisis and our whole family, because he's just showing symptoms of crisis. I mean, we're a family system, so we're all going through the crisis together. And if, you know, so this is just, I guess it's just an argument for all the more reason for more peaceful means. And I'm not saying people don't need to be contained at times, because I do think sometimes that I've seen it, at least for sure when you're drugged or coming off the drugs, the level of behavior that can happen. And I do think containment is not necessarily a bad thing to do, but do we need to do it nonviolently? Can we not provide supportive, loving, peaceful environments that provide a voice to that person so that hopefully we can avoid having to get it to a crisis level where they're having to be put away or contained? You know, if we can allow for more open dialogue. And so that's why I think, hey, I think we need to talk about this and sort of lift the shame. You know, and just an aside, I also want to say is the anxiety that ensues when you have someone who is in the psychiatric system, on drugs, in and out of hospitalizations, on and off the meds, just dealing with being stigmatized, discredited, dismissed as a human being, going through that level of all of that being ripped out from under them. And you as well as a family member, because by association, it gets ripped away from you as well. The anxiety, the social anxiety. So, well, you suffer from social anxiety disorders. Well, my God, is there any wonder? I'm living what society has shown me about who and what it is a pretty terrifying thing. And so, you know, anyway, that's, the anxiety, it becomes very difficult to focus on one's life when you're busy taking care of your father 24/7, even as an adult. And the loss of human potential is not just in the person who is diagnosed, but then in the ensuing family members and the next generation and on it goes. So the loss of human potential is just beyond tragic and unnecessary. That's what's so sad. It's just hugely unnecessary.
MK, so, thank you. Yeah. This has been one of the most interesting, real, and unique times, I think, on this radio show. So I'm deeply grateful for your sharing this with us. And folks, again, this is MK Mendoza. If people want to talk with you further about this, is there a way they can get in touch with you? Would you like that?
Yes, yes, I'm all about it. And that's what my radio show is about. I want to bring a voice to this community, to this struggle. So, yes, they can dialogue@ksfr.org. dialogue@ksfr.org, ksfr.org. Yeah, absolutely. And now I do think, you know, there's, I don't want to just keep going. I mean, you want to interact. I mean, I could talk all day, Peter, but please feel free to, you know, ask me questions or interact or
Well, yeah, well, let me take a minute and give you a chance to take a breath. But I do think that that everything you're saying is incredibly important. And I think it's the most vividly and honestly and honorably described as I've ever heard it. I wanted to ask you two or three just factual questions that might help orient people a little further. And then make a brief comment and then ask you to talk about a few things. So, well, first of all, your dad, when did your father finally die?
He died last year. He was 88. He died last year, August 8th.
Okay.
Actually, it was.
And he was 88 years old?
Yes. But now I tell you, I know that's a long life, but my dad, we had longevity on our side. And I truly believe he would have been one of those. And it's not just the young child denial. You know, that's the other thing. Yeah. Oh, you're just denying. You don't want your dad to be crazy. That's why you're finding all these justifications. And it's like, oh, God, no, no. It's just I don't think he is crazy. You know,
well, let me respond to that. Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm 81 years old. I'm going to be 82 on May 11th. And
we recently
had join us as an extended family. It's the first time I've been in an extended family since my children grew up. Ginger's mom, Jean, whom I love dearly, has actually come to live with us. And she's 91. And again, you know, she's so present and so much there that I can understand that that not only could your dad's life been robbed from him while he was alive, but also that he could have had many more years to go. People are living longer and longer now. Now, one of the questions I wanted to ask, just to sort of orient people to the story, the development of the story. And just a couple of brief factual things. Your mother and father were together, and did you have siblings?
Yes, I had two older brothers.
Brothers and sisters? Yeah.
Brothers, two older brothers. And the scapegoating is really a critical part of that dynamic. You know, I don't want this disease. You have it. I mean, everybody, you know, it's a pointing of the fingers. It almost becomes a competition of whose fault it is. I mean, it's or who carries the next, who's going to be the carrier of it so that I can be off the hook. You know, which is just
who's
going to
get,
you know,
well, go ahead and talk about that for a bit. And I have other things that like we can come back to, but talk about what you're saying here about the scapegoating and the blaming.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, I think back to that whole thing of just, oh my God, I don't want to be him. And I'm just going to, I'll call him by his name. I think it's perfectly fine. His name is Hernando. So I don't want to be Hernando. Nobody wants to be Hernando. Oh my God. So, we don't want to be in his shape. So, hey, MK, you're the crazy one. And believe me, it has been years trying. And because I was the youngest and I was the only female, I was an easy target, very easy. But what they also didn't know is I'm a fighter. And I got that from my mother and my father both. And I'm also intelligent and I research things and I find things out. And one of the things that you talk about, Peter, that's so important is the idea of having a grounded sense of what you believe. And when you know there is grounded factual information, you can calm down and you can say, because I think this is a very critical thing in this how do we go forward question. Sorry, my kitty is deciding to talk to me for some reason. As we go forward in answering how do we protect ourselves as we move forward from the psychiatric system. And one of the things I think we need to do is understand that the current psychiatric model is an opinion. It's an opinion. And I have the right to another opinion. And there are many people who've had my opinion through for many, many years. So I have the right to disagree. And the back to the scapegoating and gaslighting. I mean, I think the critical thing that happens is gaslighting. There was a really good quote I have about that describes gaslighting, and I actually pulled it up. Hold on just a second. Let me see. Well, anyway, it's about the idea of causing a reaction in someone. You say something that's going to cause a reaction, and then you get the reaction, and you say, see, that's your problem. It's like the minute you say you're crazy to somebody who's not, they're going to say, what do you mean you're crazy? I'm not crazy. They're going to get, now you take them down and start taking their rights away. And it's a setup. It's a setup for insanity. Of even a normal person would react. So the critical piece in arming ourselves as we move forward in this is to say, you know, I just don't agree with your take. Because if I think they have all the power and I live in fear of that power, then what I'm going to do is panic when they come on me with a diagnosis and, you know, you're genetically defective and we have to put you away against your will because you're a harm to yourself or others. We have the power to put you away. Well, only if I react, only if I am appear to be a danger to myself and others. But if I know what I know and I soundly believe it as much as I would believe any religion, I have the right to my own belief system. So I think the more we know that as the consumer, that we have a right to that and we hold tight to that right, that's your one of your best protections. You'll never fall victim to, you know, a diagnosis. Even if you get a diagnosis, you can say, well, thank you, doctor, for your opinion. Thank you very much. And walk out the door. I mean, you know, you don't have to stay. But I think it's that fear of that drives so many people to then panic. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy from the drugs and the treatment and the, you know, the being put away against your will and so forth and so on. So the scapegoating is a critical, I believe the mentally ill are basically just the scapegoats of our society. The people who are speaking out and talking about things that make maybe all of us uncomfortable. We just don't want to talk about, we don't want to look at. But if the manner in which we're doing it, the current psychiatric model of care is absolutely destroying the cure that we're seeking, because we're really seeking human connection, and all it does is isolate, and so back to wonderful Peter Ginger, Peter Gocha, Robert Whitaker, MIA, your radio show, all the wonderful people you speak with every day, support, that is the cure to quote unquote mental illness. I really believe it's a huge piece of it. But anyway, so does that go anywhere?
Yeah, everything you're saying, yeah. I think, is so important. Have you actually thought about, I'm sure you've thought about, what are you thinking about trying to really get organized families? You know, we tried once before.
Yes.
I don't know if you were around for Mother Bear. And if you learned anything about Mother Bear, but there was an attempt that fell apart a few years ago to develop family groups, international family groups that were on the opposite end of the continuum from NAMI and CHAD, which basically are drug company support groups, to have the kind of conversation we're having now and that kind of information you're giving out, kind of support to other people that you want to give. And Mother Bear did not make it. Mm-hmm. And I participated in it. The funding dried up and it just didn't work out for reasons that I wasn't even inside enough to know. Have you been thinking about how to go about organizing this?
Yes, I have an idea. I have an idea because I've been since the discovery of Robert Whitaker, and then you, Dr. Bregan, and Ginger, who I just couldn't, and Peter Gutcha, all of you. It's so inspiring. It's like meeting sort of your long lost friends and kind of going, oh my God, where have you been all my life? So what I think is, as one of your guests, Bonnie Burstow, I hope I'm saying, or Burstow,
yes.
I'm
mm-hmm.
not sure how, okay. She talked about the idea of using entertainment. And of course, I'm a media gal. So the idea of telling stories and that is a way to capture people's attention. And what hit me, because I was thinking of writing my own book that about this very topic, right? And then I thought, wait a minute. Then I've been talking to more and more people that have had similar experiences. And I said, you know what we need? We need a vagina monologues, but about this particular topic. And I don't know if we want to call it the lie, if we want to call it fractured. We may, I mean, but this is, and I've been talking to a particular person. I won't mention her name because I'm not sure that she wants it out at this point, but she said, absolutely. And so that I would love, and if anybody is out there listening and they're interested and they want to partake or help put our heads together and create this, I think it would be wonderful if we could capture these stories. We are the stories of Robert Whitaker's book. We are the stories of Dr. Peter Bregan and Ginger. We are those stories, and it's time for us to have a voice to tell the real story, not the pharmaceutical lie.
I hear your cat cheering in the background or complaining, wanting more attention.
I'm so sorry. I don't know what's going on.
No, it's fine. It's just fine. If my Yorkie or Ginger's Yorkie, the Yorkie has chosen Ginger, were able to speak in the background, I would be pleased to have her on the show. But say hello to your cat for me. I think this is incredibly important. Once again, tell people how to get a hold of you at Dialogue.
Dialogue@ksfr.org. And the other thing is, come on my show. And that's another avenue that I'm using. I mean, because as you all have given voice to the experts, I want to use my voice in media, and I'm knock on wood working to get a podcast, which I'm very excited about. Hopefully, cross my fingers, that's going to happen. And I will make it if it doesn't somehow. But, the idea is I would like to bring voice to the experience of what I just talked about in my life and other people that are out there having this experience. So I really want my show to be a platform for the consumers. What I love about your programs is you all provide us the infrastructure of experts that come to the table. And what I would like to do is provide a platform for the consumers to come forward and say, hey, here's our story, you know. Might be working for that group over there, but it isn't working for us. And here's what it looked like for us. And
have
where
you
do
built
we go?
The website yet?
I haven't.
Well, that might be one of the directions. Folks, you may be listening
absolutely.
To the beginning of something very, very big. Because I think that your voice is incredibly important. And there's something special about it. There are a lot of people who are talking about being psychiatric survivors, and they have a great deal to say, but there aren't a lot of people talking about being the survivor of the family, family survivors, and the equivalent of the Al-Anon, as you were saying, in a way.
Right. Absolutely.
So I think this is absolutely wonderful.
I will also share this with the founder of crookedhouse.org. That's another place people can go to tell their stories if they're children of. But now I don't even call it mental illness anymore, because now I can feel free to not call it mental illness. As I was growing up, I always had a problem with it, but felt pressured to go with the flow. You know, you don't want to sound too crazy if you say so-called mental illness, they're categorize you as crazy too. So I tried to shield myself from using that word more often than not, but now I embrace it proudly. I say so-called mental illness because I don't like to call it an illness. I think they are states of being. And in fact, I'm also very interested in your particular empathic therapy. I'm interested in becoming an advocate for people across all these realms of, you know, learning about benzodiazepine withdrawal, just psychiatric drug withdrawal in general. And I'm particularly interested in speaking to people who hear voices. I particularly have an interest in that particular group population, but that's a whole other. That's kind of a separate topic. That has to do with the fact that I have sleep paralysis. And so I have a feeling they may be dreaming while they're awake. I'm very curious. And I just really want to work against the destigmatization of these illnesses, because I think that's where the most damage is done, without question.
There's actually a body of connecting literature that I was exploring at one point. between hypnagogic images and other phenomena of sleep and awake, and people who are hallucinating while awake when it has nothing to do with sleep. So lots of people, there's even a great big book about it somewhere in my shelves of where these people are trying to bring together some of these themes. But you're looking at all the things that are interesting and all the things that are important, certainly the things that have that keep drawing my attention. I think the way you're thinking about these things is incredibly important. Is this one of the first times you've had a chance to talk to an audience of hundreds?
Yes, I mean, other than my radio show. Yeah, about this. I haven't really spoken about my, I mention it a little here and there on my radio show, but I haven't really gone into the depths of it. And I've wanted to, I've been dying to talk about it. Yeah. And back to your empathic therapy. I mean, again, and its connection to the stigmatizing experience. It's so important, and why I believe the consumer, this is a movement to empower the consumer. If we begin to look at alternative treatments, to take your classes, to, you know, get certified and become experts via lived experience, and we come with an extremely empathetic viewpoint to help people, because that's one thing, again, back to dealing with it as families, there's such shame. Because everybody's terrified of having, of not belonging. I mean, I refer to mental illness as sort of the, our equivalent of the untouchables of our society. So nobody wants to be a part of that group. You know, it's just this, oh God, I don't want to be a part of those guys. And we need to just obliterate the stigma. It's time to do away with it.
Well, you're marvelously eloquent about this, and I am honored and delighted to be giving you a voice in another whole sphere for yourself on my radio show. And this gets archived, and there's no limit to the number of people who then download it. And you know, there's just lots and lots of people listening to this around the world through the archives, through being sent hand to hand to people, and then through the live audience itself today. These wonderful, wonderful people listening, folks. I think this is a really, really important day, an important time. I didn't know what to expect, MK, from our brief conversations together about what this day was going to be like. But I'm very inspired by you, and I want to see and think about whatever I can do to help you in addition to this show. And I want to see, you know, we'll talk about what we could do to begin to do something more, maybe that I could be helpful with. One of the questions I wanted you to talk some about was maybe just looking at when you were 10 and how your views were when you were 10, as best you can remember, and how they maybe evolved over the years. We know a lot now about how you started reading Whitaker and then found out about Others of Us. And what about when you were a 10-year-old looking at this, that your dad, who was apparently a very strong dad, was he much involved in your life? Or was he so busy as a doctor he wasn't?
No, he was like every child's dream of the ideal father. I mean, I wasn't like a daddy's girl, you know. It was just my dad was the ultimate playmate. He spent time with his. He was the ultimate family man. He got off of work. He came home. He took absolute time to be with his family, and we loved and we adored him. So to lose him was such, just like a tragedy. You know, it was just. It was more than I think any of us. He was in many ways the glue. I mean, the helm at the helm, sort of moving the adventure of life forward, you know. And it's interesting because when I a lot of times, this is again back to the personal stuff of the family dynamic, but as the youngest and the only female, you're often thinking, oh gosh, you start self-dismissing, you know, dismissing your own point of view, questioning yourself. But I I now, because you're the youngest, what do you know? Maybe you are wrong. You're more likely to be wrong than not. But yet now I look back as an adult, and I often joke that I'm still 10 years old, you know, don't let the adult body fool you. I'm just eternally that age, because I think there's something special that happens at 10, 11, 12, where hormones haven't hit and we don't know it all, but we're starting to understand the depths of life, the challenges, the questions. And so in some ways, I think it taught me to listen to my intuitive self, my truthful self, my own truth against the powers that be. And it taught me to listen quite extensively to that, almost like a honed skill, almost to the point where I can walk in a room and kind of go, ooh, I can sort of read people more than maybe the average person, I can read the emotional landscape a lot of times. And that's not always a good thing, because it's like, oh, why do I wish I didn't have this. On the other hand, you can use it, you know, turn to make it work in your benefit, you know, to your benefit. But I want to say something real quick, because I've talked about the shame and the blame and the scapegoating and all that. But I do want to say a big, big piece for me in moving to the other side of finding solutions and moving forward with family and, you know, ridding ourselves of the shame is, number one, allowing ourselves to talk about it. Number two, realizing that we are, in a sense, victims of the bad guy, which is the system. And not to say that people don't make up the system, because people do, and each of our own individual choices contributes and makes up the system. But we really were told a lie, and it was a lie that was made for profit. It's basically profiteering. You know, people are just profiting off of our vulnerability. And it's about the story of seeing what you want to believe. So we want to believe there's easy answers to some of these more difficult questions. And so it's easy for families to fall victim or prey to that. And I think it's really important to forgive ourselves for that. Even when we might have that survivor guilt of, oh my God, I put my family, you know, it's like being a Holocaust survivor. I mean, in many ways, it's like, oh my God, how did I ever let my father go through electroshock treatment? How did I let that happen for a minute?
How old were you then?
I was actually in college by then. And that, you know, and yet it's like, okay, by then I was sort of, okay, well, I was on with the program, take your meds, pop, you know, stay on the program, you know, religiously take your meds. And he did, even my dad. And yet all the while there was this sort of underlying feeling of like, it just always felt like we sort of had to talk ourselves into it. Like it didn't completely resonate. And that's why Robert Whitaker's book was such a light bulb moment of, oh my God, the answers that finally somebody explained what I was seeing. And now I just believe that my dad was a victim of the psychiatric system, and as was my family. And I don't blame my family. I think it's very important not to blame your family or hate your family, but forgive, understand that everybody was doing what they were doing out of their own fear and anxiety. And who wouldn't be afraid and anxious under those conditions? Yeah. You know,
MK, which of Bob's books was it? Was it Madden America, or was it
Anatomy of an Epidemic? Yes. Yes.
Anatomy?
Yeah. Anatomy, yeah. Yes. Yeah,
I hear that, you know, so. Yeah, go ahead.
This is just for the fun of it. Everyone has rock stars when they're growing up. I never did. But since I've discovered you, Ginger, Robert Whitaker, Lisa Cosgrove, Peter Gertz, you guys are my rock stars. You are my rock stars.
Well, you've got a charisma of your own, and a devotion and a passion and an intelligence and an experience that, you know, you could be such a part of all that's happening right now. I just want to encourage you and folks, you know, get in touch with her, get in touch with MK Mendoza. Maybe there's somebody out there who'll get in touch with you and help you do a website.
Absolutely.
It's pretty simple to get started with a website. Eventually, you may need something that requires more than just a little help. But in the beginning, to get started on a website is not very difficult.
Right.
Difficult for me, but not for a lot of other people. people.
Yeah, no, yeah, and I can certainly, I'm capable. It's a matter of having the time while I work my other jobs. And
people. I mean, you start asking around, you know, with the people you know, you're going to find people who would be probably happy to spend an hour or two and just set up a beginning website for you. We could put your radio shows on or whatever else. But I want to talk with you more about this off the air, too, and explore with you what you could begin to do as we move along. Now, we've got only about 3 or 4 minutes left. You said that in college that you were in with the system.
Yeah.
When did you read Whitaker's book? When did you start breaking out, or did you start breaking out first?
Oh no. There's always been a part of me underlying that was breaking out all the time alongside my father. And that's why, you know, I got scapegoated. Oh, you're the crazy one. I mean, and yet my family has never had any real evidence. It happened in the last year after my dad died. And it took, unfortunately, me watching my father's death, which I feel was hastened by the long-term effects of these drugs. It took that in order to finally wake me up and say, oh my God, no, wait a minute. People die of the effects of these drugs. And this is a life and death issue. And we have to wake up and we have to say, no, this is, whether my family's with me or they're not, I don't care. I don't care if they think I'm crazy. I don't care what they think. This is wrong. What's happening is wrong. And we are now at a point in time where we can't, it's not about blood anymore. It's about ethics. It's about where you stand from an ethical standpoint. And I knew I had to stand on the side of my ethics. And that's why I love the idea of you promoting, you know, the future lays in our ethic, our ethical decisions that we make as human beings going forward. So that's kind of how and where, you know, I guess I made that change.
Well, this is really so good. And you certainly get what I'm about. And I think I get what you're about. And I think that...
I love you guys.
What was that?
I love you guys.
Well, I love you too. And I've just met you, basically. I mean, I had such a good time on your radio show. You were just so able to bring out the best in me that I just thought, I mean, this has got to be interesting. And we didn't have a topic selected until basically 2 minutes before going on air, basically, when we were chatting. And it turned out that this is I think you were a little awestruck. And when you got over being awestruck, you told me what you were about.
Yeah, I had to meet my rock star. You know, it's kind of nervous when you get nervous when you're meeting your rock star.
You outperformed anybody I know. No one could have had a better performance as a rock star today. Folks, I hope you really let everyone know about this particular show. I rarely ask you to do that. Give M.K. Mendoza a hand of appreciation and let folks know about her. And if you can lend her a hand, get in touch with her. And as the music is going to start any minute now, one more time, M.K., how people can get in touch with you.
Dialogue at KS, as in Sam, F as in Frank, R, KSFR.org. Thank you. It's been an honor, Peter Bregan. Thank you so much.
MK, for being on the show. What a marvelous surprise for me and maybe for lots of other people. Goodbye, my wonderful audience. Bye-bye for now.
Goodbye. Thank you so much.